For most of recorded European history, fairies were understood as a class of beings who occupied the same physical world as humans, yet remained separate from them. They were described as organized populations with territories, customs, and internal hierarchies. People believed they lived in identifiable locations, earthen mounds, hills, forests, and particular trees, and treated those locations as inhabited spaces rather than a neutral terrain. Belief in fairies shaped daily behavior. It influenced where people built homes, how they traveled, what land they cultivated, and how they explained misfortune. These beliefs were shared across regions and persisted for centuries, often remaining stable even as political and religious systems changed around them. This episode traces how fairies were understood in the earliest sources, how those understandings developed over time, and how they were eventually transformed into the figures that appear in the modern pop culture. The focus here is historical record, what people said fairies were, how they behaved toward them, and what those beliefs accomplished within the societies that held them. We'd like to welcome you in to the Ominous Archives. Welcome. I am Nick.
No, ma'am.
And we are covering fairies today.
I'm so excited about this one.
So am I. This could be a long one.
I don't care. It's worth it. It's such fun topic.
Yeah. I mean, it might be a two-parter. Like, we can get into everything that, like, we're going to cover, and then you can always deep dive into each individual fairy itself, because there's, like, multiple ones, and, like, there's so many different things. I just was touching up on just some knowledge about them on my way home from work, and, you know, gnomes and all kinds of different things are listed as fairies. It's wild. But I guess we won't hang on any longer. It's not like we have a ton of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, we're pretty boring people, so, I feel.
Well, yeah, and we're always a week ahead. Right. So it's Friday the 13th for us. Yeah. And you're just getting cracking on the 13th. So yes. Nothing weird's happened today.
Not yet. No. It's only two, Nick. Don't say never.
Yeah, that's true. But anyway, we'll just jump right in. The earliest description of fairy-like beings come from oral traditions that long predate written records. When those traditions were eventually written down, they show a striking level of agreement about one thing. Fairies were understood to live somewhere specific. They were not imagined as drifting spirits or distant beings. They belonged to the land, not metaphorically, but geographically. In Ireland, they were known as the Asosi, the people of the mounds. The mounds themselves were ancient burial sites, already old when medieval communities formed around them. These were not treated as abandoned monuments. They were treated as occupied places. People avoided them, they worked around them, and they spoke of them carefully. Disturbing a mound was believed to carry consequences. You could get sick suddenly. You could get persistent pain. Your livestock could waste away. Your crops could just fail for no reason. These outcomes were understood as results of interferences. Something had been done where it should not have been done. In Wales, similar beings were known as the Twlith Teg, the Fair Family. The name itself suggests organization and kinship, rather than chaos. They were believed to live close to human settlements, sometimes uncomfortably close. You know, that kind of feeling. A little too close.
Little
my
too
personal
close.
Bubble.
I don't like it.
While remaining socially separate. The boundary between them and humans was understood to exist, but it was not always visible. Scottish traditions describe fairies as inhabitants of hills, glens, and underground dwellings. The word Sith refers to both peace and the other world, implying a parallel domain that exists alongside the human one. Fairy places were not distant. They were nearby, often encountered by accident.
Fairies were regarded as dangerous in practical, immediate ways. They were held responsible for illnesses that appeared suddenly and resisted explanation. Sharp pains, unexplained rashes, lameness, wasting conditions, and ailments affecting animals were often attributed to fairy involvement. This belief extended into early medieval practice. English and Irish medical texts contain remedies intended specifically for injuries or illnesses caused by elves or fairies. These were not marginal ideas. They were part of how people understood health, vulnerability, and recovery. Fairies were also associated with disorientation. Many accounts describe people being led off paths at night, particularly into bogs, pits, or unstable ground. These incidents were remembered as encounters rather than accidents. The landscape itself was understood to become unreliable in places associated with fairy activity. By the early modern period, people began to ask where fairies came from. Of course, because where does anything come from? I feel like you need an answer for those things.
I mean, you always want to know where something comes from.
Duh.
They don't just appear.
Right, it's only right. Poof. One explanation recorded in Cornwall held that fairies were the souls of ancient pre-Christian inhabitants of the land. Similar beliefs were recorded in Wales, where some people described the Tylwyth Teg as the spirits of Druids who died before Christianity arrived. These spirits were understood to exist in a suspended state, neither condemned nor redeemed, remaining present in the world they once occupied. In Ireland, fairies were often identified with the Tuatha Dé Danann, a mythic race associated with power, sovereignty, and magic. After defeat, they were said to have withdrawn into the mounds, continuing their existence beneath the surface of the land. In this framework, fairy mounds were entrances. Fairy rings, naturally occurring circles in grass or mushrooms, were treated as gathering places or crossing points. They marked areas where interaction was more likely and where caution was required.
So you know what I have to relate this to? There's an episode of Bluey.
Of course there is. There's always an episode of Bluey.
Oh, man. It's almost like I just watch it way too much. But there's an episode called Fairies, and it's pretty good. There's fairy rings, but here they're talking about how it's for interaction. Bluey, she gets stuck dancing.
Of course.
And then they have to use Bingo to knock Bluey out. And they're like, why did we think? Yeah, it's great. Anyway.
Anyway,
over time, descriptions of fairies began to emphasize appearance as well as behavior. Some sources describe them as strikingly beautiful, particularly in female form. This beauty was treated as a hazard rather than a reassurance. In these accounts, attraction increased the risk of harm rather than softening it. Green appears repeatedly in descriptions of fairy clothing and surroundings, reinforcing their association with vegetation, uncultivated land, and places where human control was incomplete. Across Ireland, Wales, Scotland, and England, descriptions of fairy remained remarkably consistent. They were humanoid beings who spoke, worked, celebrated, and organized themselves socially. They differed from humans in subtle yet persistent ways, proportion, movement, expression, and presence. By the medieval period in England, fairies appear frequently in written accounts. They are described as varied in sizes, temperament, and behavior. During the Tudor and Stuart periods, they were increasingly classified as beings of a middle nature, occupying a position between humans and angels. Under the broad category of fairy fell brownies, hobgoblins, banshees, pixies, elves, goblins, and imps, each associated with particular roles. Fear of fairies shaped everyday behavior, people avoided saying their names, chose routes carefully, and designed homes with fairy paths in mind. These practices were responses to a perceived presence. I heard people would leave doors open, so fairy could just go straight through.
Yeah.
And they'd make the house instead of square round, so certain types of fairies couldn't find a corner.
Right.
Taken together, these accounts point to a shared understanding, fairies, as non-human populations bound to a place, living close enough to matter and powerful enough to require attention. Then Christianity spread. And as it spread across Europe, beliefs in fairies posed a persistent classification problem. Fairies did not fit clearly into Christian categories. They were not angels, but they weren't demons in any simple sense, and not human souls as theology normally defined them. Christian writers responded in different ways, but no single explanation displaced the older, local understanding of fairies as inhabitants of the land. Some theologians proposed that fairies were fallen angels of a middle kind, excluded from both heaven and hell. Others identified them as deceptive spirits. These explanations sought to incorporate fairy belief into Christian doctrine, but they had only a limited effect on everyday practice. Among lay communities, fairies continued to be treated as neighbors governed by their own customs rather than as moral agents enforcing divine law. Accounts of fairy encounters remained particular rather than moral. People describing being summoned, escorted, or detained in accordance with rules they did not fully understand. One of the most frequently reported features of these encounters was temporal distortion. A brief stay in fairy company, followed by the discovery that years or even generations had passed. Harm resulted from a procedural error rather than sin. By the 17th century, writers began to observe a new limitation. The Scottish minister, Robert Kirk, recorded that those with the second sight could perceive fairies only on an ancestral land, ground inhabited by their people for generations. Away from that soil, the sight failed. This observation marks an important shift. Fairy encounters diminished not only with the spread of Christianity, but also with the movement. As Europeans became increasingly mobile and began to colonize distant lands, the continuity that sustained fairy perception weakened. The loss was understood as geographical rather than theological. Even in the modern period, writers such as C.S. Lewis, a scholar, argued that fairies did not disappear because they were disproven, but because people lost the habits of attention, humility, and rootedness that once made such encounters possible. In this view, fairies did not leave the world. People left the conditions under which they were seen.
From pre-Christian Europe well into the modern period, many people believed that supernatural beings could and did exchange their own children for human ones. These exchanges were described in practical terms. Fairies or other non-human beings were thought to take healthy humans, infants, and leave behind their own offspring, often described as weak, malformed, or burdensome. The reasons given were consistent. Some beings were believed to need human vitality to strengthen their own diminishing populations. Others were thought to exchange children simply to trouble human households. In either case, the exchange was understood as deliberate. What makes the changeling belief unusual is how long it lasted. Folklorists writing in the late 19th and early 20th centuries repeatedly noted that these were not ancient legends, but living beliefs. As late as the 1920s, people in parts of rural Germany were still taking precautions to prevent infant exchange, which is insane.
Mm-hmm.
Similar beliefs appear outside Europe as well, including accounts from Egypt describing the jinn stealing human infants and leaving substitutes in their place. Changelings were identified through behavior rather than appearance alone. They were often described as endlessly hungry, physically stunted, or strangely heavy. Some never learned to speak, others cried constantly. What frightened people most was the sense that the child did not change. Years passed, and the child remained the same, dependent, demanding, and unresponsive. Many changelings were believed to be far older than they appeared. Folktales describe them revealing this age accidentally, speaking with the voice or knowledge of something ancient. In some stories, a changeling was said to have lived through forests, growing and dying, or through generations of the same family struggling to feed it. This idea, that a changeling might never mature or die, made the fear worse. A single exchange could mean a lifetime, or several lifetimes, of hunger and care. Families imagined themselves trapped, unable to outlive the burden. Not all responsives were violent. Some traditions held that changelings could be exposed rather than harmed. One widespread belief was that a changeling could be forced to reveal itself through surprise, preparing food in absurd ways, such as cooking stew in eggshells, was believed to provoke laughter or speech. If the child reacted with shock or mockery, it was taken as proof that it was not human and that its supernatural parents would reclaim it. Other responses were far darker. During the Reformation, some Christian thinkers interpreted changelings as demonic beings without human souls. Martin Luther openly supported this view. He described changelings as flesh without spirit and argued that killing them was justified. This belief made abuse, neglect, and even infanticide appear morally acceptable in specific communities. What is striking is not cruelty alone, but certainty. People believed that they were acting correctly. Changelings were not treated as sick children, but as replacements, foreign beings occupying the space of someone who should have been there. As medical explanations for disability and developmental differences emerged in the 18th and 19th centuries, changeling belief began to fade. The shift was gradual. The stories did not disappear all at once, but over time, the idea that a child might not be human became harder to sustain. The word changeling survived, but its meaning changed. What had once been named a real and terrifying possibility became a historical term. One that records how people once tried to make sense of care, fear, and endurance inside the home. Changelings were rarely thought of as fairies in their own right. In most European traditions, the fairies were the agents, the ones who took the human child, while the changeling was a dependent or remnant of fairy society left behind in the exchange.
Some fairies were believed to live in close proximity to human dwellings, near farms, within adjacent hills, beneath floors, or in structures bordering settled land. These fairies were believed to closely observe human routines. They were familiar with births, illnesses, shortages, and domestic rhythms. Changelings are most often associated with this group. These fairies were taught to engage in exchange out of necessity. Some traditions held that they could not reproduce reliably. Others suggest that they required human vitality to maintain their population. Children were taken not as punishment, but as resources. These fairies were often described as conditional. They responded to courteous, generous, and careful behavior. In some cases, they were believed to return the children they had taken if certain conditions were met. Their danger lay in their attentiveness and proximity rather than overt hostility. A second category appears in accounts of adult abductions. These fairies were often described as moving in groups, sometimes called courts, companies, or routines. They travel through the landscape at night along specific routes and were frequently accompanied by music, lights, or movement. These fairies took adults rather than children, musicians, midwives, shepherds, hunters, and solitary travelers appear repeatedly in these accounts. The individuals taken were not random. They possessed skills that fairy communities were believed to value. Music, healing, navigation, or knowledge of liminal spaces such as birth and death. Adults taken by these fairies were not always held permanently. Some returned after what they experienced as a short absence. Others returned altered, withdrawn, distracted, unable to resume their former lives fully. They were often regarded as having crossed a boundary that could not be entirely undone. Time distortion is especially prominent in these encounters. A night spent with the fairy host might correspond to years passing in the human world. These experiences are recorded as disruptions of order rather than moral lessons.
I think the whole time thing of that is crazy.
Yeah.
Like the...
You could be with them for a few hours and a few weeks went by.
Yeah, what the heck am I thinking of? I think Halloween Town is the first thing that I just thought of. How, like, the time in Halloween Town is, like...
It's like it's
a
lower, right?
Yeah, it's like a year in Halloween Town and a day in, like, the... Or I think it's opposite.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That and, like, the, it brings you back, too, to, like, the National Park disappearances.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're just gone. Like, and then all of a sudden, you just... Here you are again.
Yeah.
Not all fairies, though, engaged in exchange. Some were described as explicitly hostile and territorial. These fairies were associated with dangerous landscapes, bogs, pits, rivers, dense forests, and unstable ground. Encounters with them are rarely involved in negotiation or return. These beings were blamed for leading people astray at night, drawing them off paths, puckwudgies, and into places where injury and disappearances was likely. Do you hear me make myself laugh?
I laughed at you. I'm not going to lie. That one made me giggle.
It's the first thing I thought of.
Yeah. I throw puckwudgies in there with, like,
My brain does bluey puckwudgies.
Yeah.
Like,
and Ouija boards. Don't forget about the Ouija boards. There's always somebody not closing a Ouija board.
Maybe in one of your other stories. Maybe in one coming up.
Yeah.
We should do an episode on just, like, Ouija board experiences.
We should.
That would be fun. Anyway. Unlike household or courtly fairies, they were not described as responsive to courtesy or offerings. Their behavior enforced boundaries rather than relationships. People did not attempt to appease these fairies. They avoided them. This category includes figures such as the Banshee, who did not abduct but signaled death, and other regional beings associated with the removal rather than exchange. We're going to do an episode on the Banshee.
Yeah.
Because they're wild. Anyway, their presence marked danger rather than opportunity. Some accounts describe fairies whose interactions with humans ended in permanent loss. These fairies were associated with draining vitality, causing wasting, illness, or taking individuals who never returned. They appear less frequently in records, but their constant presence suggests a recognized category. These beings were not interested in coexisting. They removed humans from circulation entirely. Encounters with them were often linked to isolation, night travel, or repeated intrusion into restricted spaces. Oh, it kind of makes me feel like there's like a, you're like the dark and the light side fairies.
Mm-hmm.
You're the ones that are like, oh, we'll coexist if you want to help, like, and give us some things or whatever. And then we have the guys who are like, no.
Yeah.
Every human needs to be eradicated.
So alongside stories of abduction and exchange, European traditions describe a range of fairy beings distinguished by their behavior, location, and relationships with humans. These were not abstract classifications, but working distinctions used to predict risk. Seelie court fairies were understood as socially ordered and conditionally cooperative. They interacted with humans who followed proper conduct and responded positively to respect, gifts, and restraint. Unseelie court fairies occupied the opposite position, as I feel like you could imagine.
Mm-hmm.
They were associated with disruption, cruelty, and harm. They were believed to interfere regardless of human intention. Avoidance rather than negotiation was the usual response. Brownies were domestic spirits tied to specific households. They performed labor quietly and without acknowledgement. Direct payment or excessive attention was believed to drive them away, which is so crazy to me.
Did you ever think of getting brownie points?
Oh my god, is that why they call them brownie points?
If only we had cameras. We need to get cameras.
Is that why they're called brownie points?
I don't know, but it sounds right.
That'd be crazy, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, because you don't really get... Wow. Okay. Pixies were associated with movement, sound, and confusion. They were known for leading people astray, particularly in rural or liminal spaces, and were rarely considered harmless, despite their playful reputation.
Cornish pixies are especially harmless.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Cornish pixies? Banshees were linked to specific families rather than places. Their cries were understood as warnings of imminent death, and their presence inspired both fear and respect. Leprechauns, which are my people, leprechauns were solitary figures associated with concealment and guarded resources. And encounters emphasized secrecy rather than exchange. Selkies belonged to coastal traditions. Their stories focused on transformation, marriage, and loss, often ending in permanent separation rather than resolution. Dryads were tied to individual trees and forests, representing localized presence rather than a roaming agency. Will-o'-the-wisp appeared as moving lights near dangerous terrain, particularly bogs and marshes, and were blamed for fatal misdirection. Elemental spirits were associated with earth, air, fire, and water. They were treated less as personalities and more as forces embedded within the environment itself. Taken together, these figures reflect a shared assumption. The world was inhabited by many kinds of non-human beings, each with different habits, tolerances, and dangers. Survival depended on knowing which rules applied and when.
Human responses to fairy risk focused on prevention rather than confrontation. People did not attempt to overpower fairies. They aimed to make themselves, their homes, and their animals difficult to interfere with. Across regions, specific materials and actions were believed to dispel fairy presence or discourage attention altogether. Iron was the most widely trusted deterrent. It could be used in almost any form. Knives, pins, horses, tongs, door bolts, or nails. Iron objects were placed near cradles, beds, thresholds, and livestock. Its presence alone was believed to mark a space as defended. Fire and heat served a similar function. Burning coal carried by travelers was thought to prevent misdirection or abduction. I mean, I guess you'd never really figure that out if somebody still went missing.
True.
Smoke from burning rags, peat, or leather was used to drive fairies away from homes, farms, and women in childbirth. Plants and natural objects marked boundaries. Rowan and hawthorn were used to signal protected space, often reinforced with red thread. Hold stones, known as adder stones, were worn or hung in briars and stables. Nettles laid on milk churns prevented interference with dairy work. These items didn't harm fairies, but they did define limits. Some substances associated with preservation and transformation were especially important. Salt was added to food or carried with milk to prevent fairies from stealing. Amber beads sewn in the children's clothing were believed to prevent abduction. Some protections relied on disgust or disruption rather than symbolism. Blood was believed in some regions to drive fairies away. Burning leather and the presence of certain animals, such as a black cockerel, served the same purpose. Strong smells were repeatedly emphasized as effective. Finally, religious items were often included, especially after Christian influence increased. Bibles, prayer books, palms, or even torn pages were carried or placed openly. Straw or hair crosses were often woven for livestock. These objects were believed to repel fairies by association, regardless of doctrine. People assumed that fairies noticed human behavior, evaluated risk, and chose the easier targets. Path of least resistance. The greatest danger was not fairy hostility, but uncertainty. Misreading a situation, using the wrong precaution, or failing to recognize which kind of presence one was dealing with until it was too late. There's things, so I've seen it in a couple, like, friends' houses, and my mom reminds me of somebody who would do this, but having iron scissors in your bedside stand.
Yeah.
People putting them, like, next to babies' things.
Mm-hmm.
An old iron horseshoe.
Mm-hmm.
Placing it above your doorway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also wild that, I guess because salt's pure, or is, like, supposed to be pure.
Right.
Whatever. Like, not in science class anymore. But, it repels, like, everything. Ghosts. Like, mm-hmm. you put a line they can't cross. And
yeah.
Frank just watched a scary movie where, I don't know what the grandmom or whatever was possessing people, or I don't know what the heck she was doing, but whatever it is, these people went nuts. But if you put a salt line down, they couldn't cross it. But if you crossed the salt line, it was like all bets were off. It was it was weird.
It was weird.
I only saw a little bit of it.
It comes back to salt.
Yeah, it comes back to salt and iron.
The fairies shift conceded with a physical change. Enclosure, industrial development, and urban expansion disrupted the landscapes that had anchored fairy belief. As fairy sites disappeared or were rendered inaccessible, fairies themselves became less immediate. By the early modern period, fairies increasingly moved from lived belief into literature. In English writing, figures such as Oberon, Tiana, and Puck became widely known through A Midsummer's Night Dream. Here, fairies still interfere in human lives, but their actions have narrative consequences rather than long-term harm. Recent horror also returns explicitly to older fairy models, as seen in The Watchers by A.M. Shine and its film adaptation. The story presents fairies as organized, territorial beings who closely observe humans to take their place in society. Film has done the most to stabilize a single fairy image. Animated adaptations by Disney, including Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, and Beauty and the Beast, established fairies as winged and morally instructive. Later, live-action films, such as Maleficent, revisited these stories, often reframing villains and emphasizing personal motivation. Two figures mark the endpoint of this transformation. My girl Tink. Tinkerbell reduces the fairy to an emotional individual whose existence depends on belief, while the Tooth Fairy turns supernatural exchange into a comforting childhood ritual. Risk is removed, but the structure remains. Despite these changes, certain features endure. Fairies remain tied to place, exchange, and altered consequences.
Even after hours of research and reading up on the lore of fairies, this episode barely scratches the surface. Historical records describe hundreds of different fairy beings, many of them known only in specific places. Across Europe, fairies were known by many names. In Ireland, the Aesi. In Wales, the Tylwyth Teg. In Scotland, the Seith. In England, elves, fays, or the good folk, a careful name chosen to avoid offense rather than express affection. The names changed, the fear did not. Fairies were understood as non-human populations who shared the land and enforced their own boundaries. They caused illness, they led travelers astray, they took children and adults. Some were returned, altered. Many were not. These beings did not judge morally or reward virtue. They reacted to the intrusion. There were fairies associated with growth and fertility, as well as with forests and fields. Some were said to help when treated correctly. But even these were never safe. Their favor was conditional, temporary, and easily withdrawn. Respect reduced risk. It did not eliminate it. The fairies most firmly rooted in memory were the dangerous ones, who exchanged children, those who drained vitality, those who removed people from the world entirely. People adapted. They placed iron near beds, carried fire and salt, avoided certain trees and hills, and learned when not to speak or linger. As landscapes changed, the communities became mobile. Fairies retreated from daily life into stories. They shrank. They softened. But the older version never vanished entirely. In dark tales and uneasy places, fairies still appear as they once were, organized, indifferent, and unmoved by human intention. I think it's a... I kind of almost like it's that whole magic thing where as you grow up and you get into, like, adulthood, mm-hmm. like, you can't, you don't see ghosts or you don't do that because you're not aligned.
Right.
And I feel like you have to keep yourself in line. And, like, as adults, we get so, like, stressed and we're told not to believe in things and this and that because this is how it's supposed to be. And it kind of, like, shuts that switch off in you.
Yeah.
And I think it takes a lot to get that switch to, like, turn it back on. But, like, little kids see it. They see them and they can do all that stuff all the time because they're so innocent and they're just open to everything. Like, they don't know. You know?
Yeah, I agree.
But, anyway. Thank you for tuning in. And please make sure to follow us on the socials by searching Ominous Archives. This episode was written by Sam from Scare Me Sam. And you can check out her podcast where she reviews horror, thriller, and dark fantasy books. Alright, that's going to definitely wrap us up because it sounds like there's something going on downstairs in the Ominous Library, and we're going to send M to go check it out. So stay weird and stay haunted. See ya.
See ya.